With this period of the retreat, we've turned a serious corner to the process of getting ready to start the next retreat. And so we take it that part of the hope here at IRC is that the last day and a half of retreat, is seen as being a very important time for practice. It's very easy for thoughts about to come back, get busier with our thinking, think about leaving. It's very easy to have feelings come back. It's very easy for your personality to come back. And, you know, all kinds of things that were kind of put to rest for a while. And then it's easy to think that, well, the retreat's over then. It's really only if you go into some calm place, then it really counts. And when you're out of the calm, then, well, you might as well, it's over, and you might as well just kick back and, you know, pull out the comic books you brought with you and, you know, and just do whatever you do. But in fact, this period is very important, and there's a long tradition in Buddhism that it's the coming out of settled states, calm states, peaceful states, coming out of retreat, coming out of meditation, that where some of the most important work can be done, of insight, of understanding, of freedom. If we kind of stay attentive, we stay present, and even though maybe the mindfulness is not as strong, there's not much support for it because the mind is busier, there's actually an opportunity to understand ourselves and see ourselves better, and an opportunity to understand what it means not to get caught, or what it means to be patient and equanimous, what it means to be compassionate and caring, in a whole different way. So I hope that in the hours that are left for the retreat, that you will take that into heart and consider that this is actually an important part of the retreat, and how you reflect on it and how you're present for yourself now, that is just as important as any other part time of the retreat. But the energy changes and events change, and when have the talks change, and there's more energy and all kinds of things. So it's all part of this transition that we're making together. I'd like to say a few words, maybe concluding words, about our theme on the five faculties, and then we'll take a period of questions and answers, that you can ask questions rather than just write them down, and then we'll try to answer up here. And then we have some announcements to make and about the closing and things you need to know. So in thinking about the theme of the five faculties, there is a story, a Buddhist fable, of a young man who decides to go travel the world, explore things. And before he heads off, while he's sleeping, someone sews into the lining of his coat a very expensive, very valuable jewel. But it doesn't tell him. So he puts on the coat and he heads off into the world. And he wanders off around and for many years and gets lost and destitute and for all kinds of challenges, but finally makes it back home after many years and comes home completely poor and destitute and with clothes and shambles. And so people say, well, what happened to you? And he describes, you know, how, you know, he was so poor, he almost died from starvation and the cold and all these things. And then the person who sewed the jewel and the lining said, well, actually, you know, you didn't have to do all that. it's still in there. You patted the jewel. You have this amazing amount of wealth right there, you know, in your coat. And so that's a little silly fable. And it's supposed to be a metaphor for ourselves, that we actually have in our lining of our heart or somewhere, a jewel. But we don't know it's there, so we wander around, and in our peculiar way, maybe, unique way, according to the metaphor and the story, we're kind of maybe destitute sometimes, and that, you know, we don't understand our wealth and what's available to us. And it's right here, carrying with us all the time. And so one of the wealths that we carry with us is are the five faculties that, as Brian talked about today, become the five powers. And these are a tremendous resource for ourselves that is available if we recognize them and support them, and almost if we identify with them. You know, identifying is a little bit, you know, Buddhists are a little bit, tentative about this identification thing. But if you need to identify with something, identify with the five faculties. And it's a much better thing to identify than with, you know, a lot of the usual ways in which you hold self-identity, perhaps. Certainly a very effective thing to recognize and appreciate about yourself. And so much so that, in terms of the analogy of standing on the dry, safe shore and not getting on the boats, the dry shore are the five faculties. Then we take a stand in them. We recognize them. We let them come to the forefront. We identify with them as being part of what's here and part of who we are. So that rather than identifying with our mistakes or identifying with our past or identifying with our, inadequacies or our fears or identifying with our opinions, we can identify with confidence. We can identify with effort and energy. We can identify with wisdom, with mindfulness and awareness, identify with concentration and with wisdom. It takes a while to get the hang of how these work for us. The idea is to learn to identify them in ourselves. And, you know, it takes a while to really understand what is this mindfulness? What is this concentration? How is it personally mine? How do I identify it in myself? And so it might take a while listening to talks, maybe doing some study, talking to teachers, to really kind of understand for yourself what it means for you, how you can recognize it in yourself. So it's not something abstract, it's not something out there, but you come to realize it is you. It is you. You are these things. You are many things, but you are these things as well. And if you, once you recognize that you are these things, then there might be a stronger ability to stand on the shore and let the boats go by. You can wave at the boats, you can cheer them on, appreciate them, you can throw them donuts, you could have all kinds of, relationship with boats, and you might invite them, to dock at your pier, and you tie them up really good. And so then you can get on. So it's safe to get on, and then you can get off, and you can kind of be a little bit in charge, get along with, have a good time. Some of those showboats are great. but you make sure that not only you tie them up, but maybe you put a lock on them. So you get on the boat, and have a good time, and then you jump off as soon as the boat's going to take off, so you're kind of more in charge. You're more kind of you have choice. You're kind of clearly cognizant and clearly aware of what you're doing and why you're doing it and how you're doing it. So you're not being swept away or caught or invisible forces inside of you kind of take over. And so to learn to identify your wealth that you have. In many ways, the Buddha talked about that we have inner wealth, and that loving kindness, the Buddha said, is wealth for a monastic person. The five faculties are wealth. So the seven factors of awakening are kind of wealth. There's all these beautiful qualities that we have, and jewels that we have. So when I was a Zen monk, like Brian sitting up on platforms a lot, I sat facing the wall. I think he sat facing out, right? Big, huge, you know, divide between our two schools of Zen. It's surprising we get along so well. So we, you know, I was happily meditating. I was there to meditate a lot and looking forward to the beginning of a new practice period in September. And they announced the jobs for the practice period. And I was assigned to the kitchen. So what? And I knew by the time I knew that you're in the kitchen, you can't meditate very much. What? So, but you know, you don't, there's not much choice. You just do what you're told in the monastery. So I remember very well the first day I went to work in the kitchen in the monastery. And the kitchen was big, and I was intimidated. I was small, you know, small little kid, big kitchen, and you didn't know where anything was or how to do it, and you know, anything. And it turned out that I ended up working in the kitchen for a whole year. And at the end of that year, it was almost exactly a year later, I had my last day in the kitchen. And I remember my last day in the kitchen, during that last day of the kitchen, I remember my first day and how small I felt in this big room, big kitchen. And now, a year later, it was a small kitchen and I was big. And it was quite remarkable to see that difference, that I had kind of gotten bigger. And some of the things that helped me become big was that now I had a lot of confidence in the kitchen. I knew my way around. I knew how to cook. I didn't know how to cook before. And I knew how to cook, and I knew how to take care of and run a kitchen, run teams of people. I knew how to make effort. I knew the energy that was needed to be sustainable in the kitchen and to apply myself. And I learned a lot about being wholehearted effort in doing an activity. I learned in the Zen kitchen. So you really put yourself into what you're doing when you're doing it. And then I learned about mindfulness, many things about mindfulness in the kitchen. I learned not only to be mindful of what I was doing, but also I had to learn a peripheral mindfulness awareness of what was everyone else was doing, because they were walking around with hot pans of water and sharp knives, and you know, you kind of have to do this dance and kind of get out of the way and, you know, figure out what's going on. And so, you know, it was a kind of wonderful example of present moment mindfulness. I learned about concentration. I learned about working really focused. There were times when somehow we ruined the meal 10 minutes before, 12 minutes before it was due to be served. I mean, we dropped it on the floor, you know. And so, you know, we had to be really focused to get something prepared from scratch in 12 minutes to be able to serve. And the thing that we mostly did then was cabbage. You can chop and wash and get cabbage sautéed or something really quickly. And so that worked out well. But, you know, really focused, right? And really focused in that. And then I learned about, you know, discernment, wisdom, understanding about how to be, all these different things in the kitchen. So all these things over a year grew in me. And as those got stronger in me, I became bigger in a certain kind of way. And as I became bigger, all kinds of things sloughed off, like the skin sloughs off. So what you say in English? Sloughed off the skin, off the snake. You know, my fear around the kitchen and doing things, my way I was intimidated by other people in the kitchen, and my wonderful desire had to be liked by everyone. It really was the kitchen at the monastery that kind of, you know, made it impossible. And I realized it was impossible task, because I became the kitchen manager. And in a Zen monastery, if you're the kitchen manager, it's impossible. It's a pressure cooker. It's a very difficult place to work, and all the stuff comes out. It's like people's stuff. And if you're the manager, it's like you're like, it's a wild place. And so I remember once I told a woman in the kitchen that she had to cut the cucumbers a little bit smaller so they'd fit in these little bowls where they had to go into where people ate. And she burst into tears. Or this man who came to me, Gil, I need to talk to you outside. And he said, if you weren't so sincere, I'd punch you out. Or another person, I learned a great example of, I guess it's called a white anger. It was so beautiful. So I was a kitchen, manager, and I told someone something. I think I was kind of off. I'm sure I was off. And he turned to me, and he this white anger, right? And he said, don't ever do that again. And the communication was completely like a transmission, like lightning. It was beautiful because of the purity of it. Pure anger was like a jewel. You're like, wow. But what was really special was for me, this was the real education for me, was that as soon as he said it, it was gone in him. It was all completely gone. He had no more anger. So it lasted a second, 2 seconds. I got the message. Message delivered. And he completely let it go. So anyway, so that's the kind of place it was at, right? So, to have people like you was... Anyway, so I learned to let go of that to some degree in there. So I learned to let... So all this stuff sloughed off. I became bigger in a good way. So this thing for you as well. May you become bigger. May you stand on this earth strong and upright and willing to be there in a powerful way. This idea of not self in Buddhism doesn't mean that you have to become, a wimp and, kind of just recede into the background and humble and as if you don't really count. If anything, this not self teaching is meant to let you grow big and slough off all kinds of things. And ironically enough, the bigger you become this way, and the more these inner strengths have a chance, you'll also slough off your selfishness. So you don't have to worry about becoming big. Because sometimes people are afraid, if I become big, then it seems like I'm too much self here. But that's not going to survive if the five faculties grow in you and develop in you. So I encourage you to make it personal for yourself. Really kind of spend time learning more and learning what it can really mean for you, the word faith or confidence. What does it mean for you to have this energy or mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom? It takes a while, but you can really say, oh, it's in me. It's not in a book. It's not out there. It's your jewels. It's your strength. Okay? The five faculties. So now is your turn to ask us questions. And what we thought we would do is you could start, we just go down the line here. And maybe first, if one of you would like to ask a question of Susie. And then after she answers, you can ask a question of Brian. And then myself. So,
I
Can you take the, so everyone can hear? Thank you.
Sometimes I sit to meditate and want to start with metta, and I can't feel the love. And I wonder if you have suggestions about what to do in that moment.
That's okay. It's okay that you don't feel the love in that moment. A lot of metta practice is forming the intention to friendliness and an intention of open-handed well-wishing. And so even if it's not some big warm feeling, by doing the practice, you are orienting in that direction. You're making that gift to yourself of that intention. And when we form that intention again and again, then it shows up. And the rest will follow.
And a question for Brian.
Would be not a very smart question, but I'm wondering what the signs that the Buddha is making with his hands mean. Well, here it doesn't do much, but like sometimes, yeah, there are like, I don't know, weird signs with the hands, no? Yeah, stuff like that.
So the thing that Susie just did, or
yeah.
In Jen?
Oh, like, it's not always the same fingers, I think. I don't know. It's just on the statues.
Gotcha, the different hand positions and what
yeah.
they mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have no idea. My colleagues might, but... That is my answer.
I know a couple of Go ahead.
Yeah.
I will say there. Thanks. I will say there's many of them, and they're called mudras, and the different mudras do have different meanings and different schools have ones that they might emphasize. There's a couple that are, you say he's not doing much there, but he's doing something there that's really important. This is the position that he took on the night of his enlightenment. It's the touching the earth. And what it is there's a moment in the story that Mara comes to him and says, this is that self-doubt coming, or, you know, this, you know, who do you think you are to, like, become enlightened? Where did you get the idea that you could do that? And he reaches down and touches the earth. And it's, the earth is my witness. And it's, each of us can make that motion. It's like, I am here, and just as I am connected to the earth, I have a right to be here. So it's a very important, dignified, I'm here. The one that I started to do this way, and I might have the fingers wrong, but I think, is it the other way?
Something like they're that. Crossing each other, I think.
Yeah. Like it's the teaching mudra. It's the Buddha in his, and it represents giving the teachings. You might know some more of them.
I know one's ever told me this, but I think it's, I suspect it's because he's going through one of his lists. Making sure he gets them all, you know. And the, and this one here, mudra, is fearlessness. I'm not sure. This one's fearlessness, or this one, and the other one is friendliness. So being friendly and fearless. I'm not sure which one it is, up or down. So there's just lots of them. They mean different things, particular things, but the language of themselves.
I have one, Gil, and I changed it to nada. The sound in the head that, you know I get it,
yeah.
And I understand that you can actually use that like a focus point, and I'm wondering if you could, if there's any direction or anything like that.
Yeah, it's an Indian word called nada. I like to think that it's, you know, it's a little mantra in your head that says nothing, nothing, nothing. But it's an Indian word from nada. And it's not tetanus. It's just some kind of background vibrational hum that some people can hear and tune into, and it's kind of more or less constant. And there are some people who use it as a primary meditation object, and can apparently get quite absorbed in that because of the constant. It's always there, and because it's so constant, and so unconnected to the usual coming and going of daily life. By tuning into that, one kind of disengages or is not caught or freed from ordinary life, and it helps keep us from getting pulled into the world. In our Buddhist scene, it seemed to have become popular locally through Ajahn Amaro, who liked to do it, and I think he learned it from his teacher, Ajahn Sumedho. So I know some people find it useful, and I've never really done it, and I can't really speak much more about it than that. So maybe we have time for one more question, maybe for Susie.
For Brian.
Oh, he got it. He deflected that one. Oh.
I thought it was right on the point.
So I know that all of us had to fill out a form asking our intentions for coming to this retreat. Would you share some of your intention for teaching this retreat?
I guess what's coming to mind right now about my intention for teaching the retreat is a little bit about what I said in the talk I gave this afternoon is I feel passionate about the practice, and it really fills my heart to be able to kind of serve in that way, but also to practice in that way. I really do see what we're doing up here as my practice in some manner, just as the folks who are in the kitchen are doing their thing, and this is kind of the same thing in that way. So it's about that passion and about this impulse to serve.
A nice question. And, If we had more time, maybe it would be nice to hear more about this. I appreciate the question a lot. So, so one of the things I like to do at this point in the retreat is to evoke the happy kind of fact of IRC, what it is here. It's one of the things that I'm, like in terms of one of my intentions is to support a retreat center and a community of people that can offer the Dharma in this, what I think is a very meaningful way, and to have share it with many people. And as you probably can imagine, it's not a very common thing in our society to have a retreat center like this where we can offer retreats freely to people. Please come, and you get your own room and great food, and you know, this yogi need, I don't know how many of you went into the yogi need closet to see if there's, you know, it's quite a list, it's kind of amazing what's all the stuff that's there. And the idea is try to make it something kind of people come here and feel supported in the Dharma, and to do it in an open-handed way, and if with the idea that by offering it freely that we become creating a culture of generosity and gratitude and goodwill that supports the practice and supports the kind of sense of safety, hopefully, and the opening and the goodness in ourselves so we can grow and develop. and to do this in a community of all volunteers is also a pretty awesome thing. And it, you know, the, having the volunteers is what makes it possible to offer it freely. And there's many, many people who, you know, who offer their services to make this whole thing run. There's many, many people who have donated to make it, you know, the money that it takes to do things like this. And the fact that, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's, sometimes I'm a little embarrassed by how luxurious this place is. You know, my idea of what was possible was we were going to buy like a little, you know, Boy or Girl Scout camp someplace in the dark woods with redwood trees and damp and mossy, you know, camp buildings, and we would have a little, you know, have to run retreats. But and that this should have manifested is because of all the goodwill, all the tremendous amount of goodwill and inspiration and people who, so many people wanted to see this happen and came forward to support it. And it's an amazing thing that we get to practice this way and get to be supported this way, and you know, you shared in it, and some of you have shared in many different ways to make this possible. So it's something I like to evoke just to kind of, because it's part of the mudita, it's part of the joy and the appreciation, part of the delight, it's part of the nourishment. I mean, because my hope is that all of you feel nourished by this, and not only that you feel nourished, but even people who are not here feel nourished by what we do here, are inspired by it, and it's meaningful for them. And so to have a chance once in a while to kind of name that and appreciate it and make sure you all understand that what a unique and special thing it is, not to take it for granted. And my hope, again, I have intentions, no shortage of intentions. That's why it's a good thing you didn't ask me. is that this here becomes contagious, and that this kind of offering, this kind of way of having the offering the Dharma and retreats, and is something that, that people realize is possible to do, and it spreads around the land, and more people. It'd be really great to have more centers like this around. And so I wanted to share that with you as we make this change to this new phase of the retreat. So then we have, Meg has some announcements about what you need to know for closing. And you can wear this if you'd like, or just either way.
Would you want me to come up with
that? Yeah, why don't you come here, definitely. You sit right here. Do you want to wear this so it's easier?
It's okay. Okay.
Oh, it's great to be able to look around and see you all. So as we begin the gradual transition of returning to our daily lives, we want to do so in a mindful and unhurried manner. And in general, you can just trust the schedule and all will go smoothly. Tomorrow, the morning will begin in the same way, including Sangha service. Those who have morning work meditations after breakfast, please do them as usual. In the morning, we'll have two cleaning periods, one for your room and one for the center. Most of you will pack and clean your rooms at 9 a.m. and then clean the center at 10:15 a.m. Some of you may have time after breakfast to start cleaning your room and packing, but this is not necessary. But it's okay to start if you wish. And to clean your room, please follow the green instruction sheet that's in your room. It tells you what to do and where all the cleaning supplies are located. And now I'm going to just step out of the manager role for a minute to just say how much I personally I'm so grateful for this business model of generosity that we have here. And I think I'm speaking on behalf of all of us. And I would just like to thank those visionary souls who dared to do what couldn't be done, to have a retreat center where we're all invited to practice freely. So thank you for that. It's a beautiful thing. So we have donation envelopes, and they can be found on top of the Donna box, which is between the office and meeting room one in the community hall. You can place a check, cash, or credit card info in them and drop them in the slot. The instructions are on the envelopes, and your donations are very much appreciated indeed. Okay, now we come to rides. We have, yes. Thank you. There will be baskets out by the elevators tonight at the end of the day. And so tomorrow morning when you get up, you can put all your sheets right in there and they'll be washed for you. Any other questions before we do the ride sharing? Okay.
Here's a question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about the noon service? Are those people, the cleanup and that, still the same for noon?
After lunch?
Yeah.
No. You know, so the
We'll all have different jobs tomorrow morning. There's a whole schedule, and Rachel and I will be down tomorrow morning helping you figure out what to do, and then there'll be additional jobs. So if you get finished early, come see us again, and we'll give you more things to do.
The only jobs that continue that you've been doing through the week is the Sangha service job. And if any of you had the regular jobs during the week, before 8:30 in the morning tomorrow, like in the dishwashing or pot washing or something, anything before 8:30 in the morning, that continues as it has been. But after 8:30, and that job's over.
And just one thing about the Sangha service jobs, about a third of the job descriptions are missing. So if you could bring those back this evening and put them back in the folder on the little table where the lamp is by the message board, that'd be great.
Before you move off the Donna conversation, I just want to say that, you know, the first time I came, this is about my fourth time here, I didn't understand really about how accessible this was. I knew for me, you know, that it was accessible. But there's weeks when it's the whole week is done in Spanish, and anybody can come. And it's not like so many nonprofits where there's some little small staff. There's no staff. Like the people that registered us, they're volunteers, and the people that go shopping, they're volunteers. And so it really, I guess I just felt the need to testify about really, what an incredibly revolutionary vision we're living in this moment. And it does take the generosity of everybody, whether it's your energy you can give as a volunteer, or if you have a great job and you've got excess cash, that's a really great thing too. So we need all of those kinds of contributions.
Thank you.
Ready for rides?
You said at 9 a.m. you clean your room. What do you do with your stuff? Do you just keep it in your room?
Some people clean their rooms at 9, others clean their rooms at 10:15, depending on which job you get.
So a number of these questions are just right on the spot questions, but you probably got some sense by now that everything's been planned here. and so you can pretty rest assured that when you need to know something, it'll be revealed. So you might try just trusting what's going to unfold, because it's going to, we you know.
Okay, so we have two people, Lasha and Mark, who were looking for rides to the San Jose airport. Anybody going that way tomorrow? Can you take both of them?
Probably. I'll say yes. We'll just squeeze in.
Wonderful.
It's not all that far.
Thank you so much. That's great. Okay, so you can work that out together. We had one participant who left early, John Dubchuk, and I believe he had passengers in his car when he came. So if you got here with John, you may need a ride back with someone else. Anybody in that situation? Okay, where are you going? Los Altos. Anybody going to Los Altos? Ah, there we go. Okay, you're all set. Okay. Anybody else? And is there anyone else who needs a ride that we didn't know about? Yes. Where are you going? Where do I live? Okay, the last thing on my list was something we mentioned just before, was please turn in your IRC sheets and towels as early as possible tomorrow, because we need to wash them before we go. So even before the first sit, if you could get up a little bit earlier and get them in the laundry baskets before you come to the first sit, that would be lovely. The blankets just stay in your room, you fold the blankets. Yeah.
Bring it down to. Not sure where it should go, but.
No, you can. You can put it in the laundry basket. Okay, thank you. And then also, please turn in your bath mat. And we'll have laundry baskets on each floor.
I don't think those blankets should go in the washing machine. So whoever's doing laundry, but just put them aside, and we'll take care of it later. The laundry person's in the room, right? So just put it someplace out of the way.
Sure, you can pick them up whenever you like, tomorrow after the closing circle.
So this last hour is, you know, energetically very different than most of what went on during the week. And so you might feel the energy in you, the excitement, maybe even some overwhelm from it. And also there's the talk about leaving and all the things, the unknown of what's happening over the next, you know, some 14, 16 hours. So, it might be nice before we end here, just take a couple of minutes just to go back into your meditation posture and begin by, not by meditating, but in that posture, notice how you are. Just tune in and notice how you are in your body. How you are in your mind. How you are in your heart. And then no matter how you are, can you meet that with compassion and kindness, goodwill? And then you might take a couple of long, slow, deep breaths. And as you exhale, see if you can settle back in to your body. Settle into this moment. As it is.